The following episode of Lyrics of Their Life podcast deals with serious issues such as drug references, sexual references, and violence that may be distressing to some listeners. It is not suitable for children. Listener discretion is advised. Hello and welcome back to Lyrics of Their Life, the podcast that talks about the extraordinary lives lived by those that wrote or performed the songs we know and love. I'm your host Adam Hampton, and in today's episode, we jump right back into the Meatloaf story where we left off, as Meatloaf and Jim Steinman look set to release their debut album, Bat Out of Hell, changing their lives forever. All this and more in this episode of Lyrics of Their Life. So without further ado, let's get straight into it.
Prince has died at the age of 57.
This is it.
Sorry, Gary, but I was always the talented member of the band.
Keep booing, little girl. I will hit a man with glasses.
I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
Former Beatle John Lennon, who was 40, was shot and killed last night outside his luxury apartment in New York.
Asbeens shouldn't present fucking awards to Gunna Be.
Leave Britney alone!
After many long and difficult years in the making, on the 21st of October 1977, Meatloaf with Jim Steinman, now both at the age of 30, would release their debut album, titled Bat Out of Hell. Without a doubt, it would be Meatloaf's greatest album, and of course, one of the best albums of all time. The rock opera-style album wasn't to be an instant success, however, and Meatloaf and Jim had to exercise patience and work extremely hard to get the album the recognition that it deserved. Despite the head of Cleveland International Records, Steve Popovich, really pushing the radio stations to play the album and pushing parent labels Epic and CBS to promote the album, Steve's efforts would be met with pushback, as the parent labels just couldn't come to terms with funding the album, due to it being so different to what was usually a sure thing to sell. Bat Out of Hell producer Todd Rundgren believes CBS and Epic Records were largely to blame for the lack of early success, and he also claimed that the album was now, quote, damaged goods, due to the fact that they had shopped the album around so much in the early stages to different labels. Interest in the album in the US was very limited, however in the UK and Australia, the album began to grow in popularity when music videos from the album were released to the public and played on TV. On the BBC, on a show called The Old Grey Whistle Test, a video clip of Meatloaf performing Bat Out of Hell was played, which captured the attention of viewers who requested the name of the band and the song. A week later, due to popular demand, the 9-minute clip was replayed. Meatloaf would then be invited to the UK to perform live on that show, which began a wave of popularity in the UK. Back in the US, Steve Popovich continued to work hard to get the album noticed, and managed to get 4 radio stations across the US to play different songs from the album, including New York and Omaha, and by the end of the year, around 140,000 copies had been sold, However, the album was still flying under the radar without Epic or CBS's backing. The Bat Out of Hell album would actually fare much better in Canada, where it was added to the regular radio rotation by Warren Cosford at Chum FM in Toronto. Capitalising on their latest popularity here in Toronto, Meatloaf and Jim would perform at the El Moncambo in Toronto, where a riot would break out during the gig. While usually seen as a negative thing, the riot actually brought an interest by the local media, who wondered who this rebellious and mysterious new band were. The attention from this particular gig would see CBS Records book Meatloaf in for a gig at the CBS Record Convention back in New Orleans in the USA. At the CBS Record Convention, Meatloaf with Jim Steinman and their backing band known as the Neverland Express would perform the full Bat Out of Hell album with the likes of Billy Joel and other big artists that were signed to CBS in attendance. Meatloaf remembers receiving a standing ovation, with Billy Joel being particularly impressed and jumping to his feet during Bat Out of Hell. Blowing the audience away, Meatloaf claims he was told he was just the second artist to receive a standing ovation at a CBS convention, with the first being Janis Joplin. Meatloaf claims that this moment in particular was the quote, birth of Meatloaf. Meat would then speak more in depth about this convention, claiming it was the best gig of all time. When speaking to ITN magazine, he said, quote, "We closed the CBS convention in 1978. Billy Joel and everybody else stayed because they wanted to know what the hell we did. I finished for crying out loud and nobody applauded. I thought they had all left because my eyes are closed all of the time when I'm singing. It freaked me out. There was a delayed reaction. It seemed like an hour went by, even though it was a few split seconds. All of a sudden, the room exploded. Next thing I knew, they were on tables screaming and yelling. They caused $50,000 worth of damage to the room. For Crying Out Loud was supposed to be our last song, but I turned around to the band and said, start Johnny B. Good. They did, and the audience rushed the stage. There are pictures of the crowd up there with us. These are artists and record executives from CBS Records. They broke tables and chairs because they were standing on them. There's a picture of Billy Joel standing on a table in the middle of the room. After proving themselves at the CBS convention and their album still struggling to sell, Meatloaf and Jim Steinman would finally receive the financial promotion and push they were hoping for when they were booked in to appear on Saturday Night Live with host Christopher Lee on the 25th of March 1978. Known as a show that made artists huge back in the day, Saturday Night Live would catapult Meatloaf and Bat Out of Hell to success, as Meatloaf gave his all, dancing about the stage, sweating up a storm, performing both All Revved Up with No Place to Go, and Two Out of Three Ain't Bad. Meatloaf claims after this performance, they sold around 260,000 copies, compared to the usual 50,000 that bands or artists sold after appearing on this show. Meatloaf believes that during his performance, he gave listeners or viewers something different, and that possibly the way that he screamed at the end of All Revved Up, before charging towards the camera and strangling it, left the audience wanting more. The album Bat Out of Hell would eventually chart at number one in Australia, New Zealand, and the Netherlands, while it also rose to number 5 in Canada, 9 in the UK, 11 in Germany, 13 in Sweden, and 14 in the US. While in terms of commercial success, Bat Out of Hell remains the 6th best-selling album of all time, with an estimated 43 million records sold around the world. In terms of certified album sales worldwide, currently Bat Out of Hell has sold 14 million in the US, where it went 14 times platinum, 3 million sold in the UK, where it went 11 times platinum, and close to 2 million sold in Australia, where it went 26 times platinum. In the UK, it was especially popular, remaining on their charts for a total of 530 weeks up to 2023, which of course equates to over 10 years on their charts, as it currently stands as the 13th longest charting album in the UK, with Queen's Greatest Hits album from 1981 topping the list with 1,433 weeks on the chart. While in Australia, Bat Out of Hell remains the best-selling album of all time there, according to the ARIA charts. Producer Todd Rundgren claims that Steinman was inspired by The Boss, Bruce Springsteen, and his teenage angst-type music of the late 70s, while Meatloaf claims that the album had to be slightly sped up during production to fit it all into the recommended 49-minute length of an album, leaving them no choice but to cut a few of Steinman's original songs. The iconic Bat Out of Hell album cover artwork was also believed to have been thought up by Jim Steinman and was illustrated by Richard Corben, displaying a long-haired man bursting out of a hole in the ground of a graveyard, depicting hell, of course, while riding a motorcycle, as a large demonic-looking bat sits atop a gravestone in the cemetery in the background. Producer Todd Rundgren claims that Steinman was inspired by The Boss, Bruce Springsteen, and his teenage angst-type music of the late 70s, while Meatloaf claims that the album had to be slightly sped up during its production to fit it all into the recommended 49-minute length of an album, leaving them no choice but to cut a few of Steinman's original songs. While in relation to the epic song titles on the album and Jim Steinman's songwriting style, Meatloaf's manager David Sonnenberg claims that, quote, "Jim would always come up with these great titles, and then he would write a song that would try to justify the greatness of the title." Reviews for the album were initially mixed to negative, with most struggling to get the concept. However, over time it has become much more positively received and respected, remaining one of the greatest albums of all time. As Steinman later reflected in 1993, that the album was, quote, "timeless in that it didn't fit into any trend. It's never been a part of what's going on. You could release that record at any time, and it would be out of place." Jim Steinman was often asked whether the songs he wrote for the album were autobiographical, to which he denied, as he said, quote, "I never thought of them as personal songs in terms of my own life, but they were personality songs. They were all about my obsessions and images. None of them takes place in a normal world. They all take place in an extreme world, very operatic. They were all heightened. They don't take place in normal reality." For the Bat Out of Hell album, Meatloaf would attempt to do Jim's songs justice and would take on the role of a new character for each and every song, claiming he never played the same character in every song and that they all told different stories. Meatloaf claims that the songs simply don't work unless he forms a strong character and works on that character, stating that every song he's performing has a different character and that he likes to get in the mindset like an actor would, claiming that he's not a singer, he's an actor, with Meatloaf in interviews often describing himself this way. Meatloaf explained that when he wants to trigger himself to bring out a new character for his next song, while performing live, he licks his finger and taps his chest, or walks around in a circle and spins into the next character. bringing a fresh and new energy into every song as he steps into a different character or persona. Which, if you watch live gigs of Meatloaf's carefully from this time, you can actually see him changing into different characters using these methods. As he claimed, quote, "I have little triggers I do to bring them to life. Tapping my hand or whatever. It's like a spirit coming into your body. I have a wildness on stage, and if you push the right buttons, it comes out off stage too." The first single from the Bat Out of Hell album was released during October 1977 and later on the 24th of March 1978 in the UK, and was titled You Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth, aka Hot Summer Night. The booming pop rock power ballad, performed like a theatrical piece, opens with a soft-spoken verse read by Jim Steinman and female actress Marsha McLean, which reads, "On a hot summer night, would you offer your throat to the wolf with the red roses?" In what would become one of the most quirky but interesting openings to a hit record of all time, setting the scene for what is truly an epic piece of music, as from there, the song kicks into overdrive with the incredible Bruce Springsteen-like guitar riff and ups the tempo throughout the song with its catchy flowing beat, as Meatloaf belts out the lyrics in one of his best rock and roll vocal performances and sings the iconic line, "You took the words right out of my mouth. It must have been while you were kissing me." With those words, of course, being "I love you," as Meat's character becomes so overwhelmed and worked up in the lust of the moment that he forgets to say, "I love you." Some claim that even Steinman's descriptive lyrics compared to the likes of Bruce Springsteen, as Jim wrote the incredibly descriptive lyrics that paint a perfect picture for the listener, and read, "It was a hot summer night, and a beach was burning, and fog crawling over the sand. When I listen to your heart, I hear the whole world turning. I see the shooting stars falling through your trembling hands. While you were licking your lips and lipstick shining, I was dying just to ask for a taste. Oh, we were lying together in a silver lining by the light of the moon. You know there's not another moment to waste." According to Meatloaf, Hot Summer Night was one of the first songs that the pair collaborated on back in 1975, which inspired them to start working on an album together, with Meat encouraging Jim to write a shorter pop-style song as opposed to his usual drawn-out theatrical pieces. You Took the Words, aka Hot Summer Night, struggled at first to chart in the US upon its initial release in January 1978, ultimately going nowhere on the charts, but of course as radio stations started to play the album and singles like 2 Out of 3 Ain't Bad, it started to pick up in the US. Hot Summer Night was eventually re-released in the US, where it would eventually peak at number 39, receiving plenty of radio airtime, despite it being a total of 15 months after the album and first singles release. While Hot Summer Night also reached its highest position on the charts in New Zealand, making it to number 2, 3 in the Netherlands and Australia, 4 in Belgium, and 33 in the UK. Today the track is Meatloaf's 5th highest streamed song on Spotify, standing at over 60 million streams, and the music video has amassed around 30 million views on YouTube. The second single from the Bat Out of Hell album was released during March 1978 in the US, and on the 17th of July 1978 in the UK, and was titled 2 Out of 3 Ain't Bad. Yet another beautiful power ballad, but falling into the category of soft rock, 2 Out of 3 is arguably one of Meatloaf and Jim Steinman's best pieces of work, and was far more mellow compared to Hot Summer Night, as the story of the song is actually quite heartbreaking, as it sees a male and female couple experiencing difficulties navigating relationship troubles, as the male character, portrayed by Meatloaf, wants and needs their partner. However, he can't bring himself to say they're in love, as past experiences, and in particular another relationship, still haunts him, as he too was once rejected by a woman who didn't love him back, as his fear of rejection holds him back. As Meatloaf sings the lines, "I want you, I need you, but there ain't no way I'm ever gonna love you. Now don't be sad, 'cause 2 out of 3 ain't bad." Again, the song is performed in a dramatic theatrical style, and would actually become a bigger hit in the US as opposed to Hot Summer Night, as it made it to number 11 on the Billboard Hottest 100 after Meatloaf's performance on Saturday Night Live gave the album and the track a huge boost. 2 out of 3 also managed to peak at number 5 in Canada, 9 in New Zealand, 11 in both Austria and Australia, and 32 in the UK. Today, 2 out of 3 has sold close to 1.5 million copies and remains Meatloaf's 4th highest streaming song on Spotify with over 80 million streams, and is Meatloaf's 2nd most watched music video on YouTube with over 110 million views. When speaking with VH1 in 2003, Jim Steinman claims he was inspired to write the song after a cast member from one of Jim's plays, called Rheingold, named Mimi Kennedy, told him to keep his song simple, as Jim was quoted as saying, "She said, you know, when I was probably complaining why no one liked my stuff and couldn't get a deal, she says, 'Well, Steiny, your stuff is so complicated. Can't you write something simple?' And while she was saying that, the oldies station was on the radio and it was playing that old Elvis song, 'I want you, I need, whatever it was, I want you, I need you, I love you,' you know. I just started singing my own song, but it was, 'I want you, I need you, I love you.' She said, 'Why don't you write something simple like that? 'I want you, I need you, I love you.' I said, 'Well, I'll try. I don't try to make them complicated.' I remember going home and I tried so hard, but the best I could do was, 'I want you, I need you, but there ain't no way I'm ever gonna love you. So don't be sad, 'cause 2 out of 3 ain't bad.' So it was still a twist, but it was my closest to a simple song, and one Elvis could have done." When speaking to Ken Sharp, Meatloaf claimed he wasn't actually a fan of the final product that was 2 out of 3 Ain't Bad, as he was asked if he heard his songs come on the radio, if he'd listen to them or not, as Meatloaf replied, quote, "I'll listen to it if it's not the song 2 out of 3 Ain't Bad, 'cause 2 out of 3 Ain't Bad is actually sped up and I sound like the friggin' Chipmunks. I'll listen to the song, Bad Out of Hell, but I won't listen to Paradise by the Dashboard Light for too long." The third single to be released from Bad Out of Hell was the title track itself, Bad Out of Hell, which in my opinion is one of the greatest rock and roll songs of all time. With an original track length of 9 minutes and 50 seconds, this masterpiece begins with a fast-paced piano intro, played by Roy Bittan, before Todd Rundgren unleashes with a spine-tingling guitar solo, before Meatloaf comes in singing the lines, "The sirens are screaming and the fires are howling, way down in the valley tonight. There's a man in the shadows with a gun in his eye and a blade shining oh so bright." As he continues on, giving a vocal performance that's bound to give the listener goosebumps. Despite the track's slow start on the charts, it eventually made its way up to number 15 in the UK by 1979. But surprisingly, it wasn't a chart topper in the US or Australia, where it became a huge hit on radio, despite how lengthy it was. released initially in May 1978, despite its slow start on the charts, it eventually made its way to number 15 in the UK by 1979. But surprisingly, it wasn't a chart topper in the US or Australia, where it became a huge hit on radio, despite how lengthy it was. Despite this, Bat Out of Hell lives on today as an all-time classic rock and roll song that was actually written by Jim Steinman around the plot of his sci-fi Peter Pan Neverland play set in the future, as Jim claimed that it was a, quote, motorcycle crash song. He also said that he wanted to make the song, quote, the most extreme crash song of all time. And also, quote, I don't think there's ever been a more violent crash. The guy basically has his body opened up and his heart explodes like a bat out of hell. As the character in the song finds himself flung from his motorcycle after racing out of the pits of hell, only for the bike to end up in pieces and his body to be torn open and badly injured, as he faces certain death, as the lyrics read, well, I can see myself tearing up the road faster than any other boy has ever gone. And my skin is raw, but my soul is ripe, and no one's gonna stop me now. I'm gonna make my escape. But I can't stop thinking of you, and I never see the sudden curve till it's way too late. Then I'm down in the bottom of a pit in the blazing sun, torn and twisted at the foot of a burning bike. And I think somebody somewhere must be tolling a bell. And the last thing I see is my heart, still beating, breaking out of my body and flying away like a bat out of hell. Jim claims he was inspired to write the song based off of, quote, teenage tragedy songs such as Leader of the Pack, performed by the Shangri-Las, and Tell Her I Love Her, performed by Ray Peterson, both of which involve an accident with a motorcycle. As Jim Steinman said, quote, there is something so thrilling to me about that operatic narrative that involves a cataclysmic event, especially one so perfectly in tune with a teenager's world, and rock and roll, as a car or motorcycle crash. Again, the track was met with comparisons to Bruce Springsteen and his song Thunder Road from the Born to Run album. However, Meatloaf denied that this was an influence and claims that the Alfred Hitchcock film, Psycho, was heavily influential. According to Jim Steinman, he and Todd Rundgren clashed over elements in the song, with Todd disliking Steinman's idea of including real motorcycle sounds, claiming that it cheapened the song. So instead, Todd jumped on a guitar and played a riff imitating the sound of a motorcycle, which he did all in one take, and it can be heard in the song, with this effort by Todd Rundgren blowing Meatloaf away. As Meatloaf said, quote, in 15 minutes, he played the lead solo and then played the harmony guitars at the beginning. I guarantee the whole thing didn't take him more than 45 minutes, and the song itself is 10 minutes long. The most astounding thing I have ever seen in my life. While Todd Rundgren also dislikes Steinman's idea to include an all-boys choir during the softer section of the song. As Jim stated, quote, in the soft section, I wanted to have a boys choir. Todd wanted to do it with the existing vocal backup section and then speed up the tape and use other technical tricks to get the boys choir sound. I said that we needed a real boys choir, but he insisted. But it didn't work out, so we weren't able to use it. You see, I'd heard this symphony by Mahler, and I really wanted a boys choir. There's nothing more beautiful than the sound of 20 boy sopranos singing. Ultimately, this idea would be scrapped. While Todd and the band also displayed how brilliant they were by acting out other sounds through their instruments, especially during the motorcycle crash, as the bass guitarist, Kasim Sultan, imitates the beating heart, and guitarist Todd Rundgren imitates the crash with the screeching of his guitar. As the song concludes with the lyrics, like a bat out of hell, I'll be gone when the morning comes, signalling that he will both be dead and leaving his love interest behind. Much later in 1993, Bat Out of Hell would eventually climb to number 8 on the UK charts, thanks to a renewed interest in Meatloaf at the time, while today the song has been streamed over 97 million times on Spotify and viewed on YouTube over 42 million times. The fourth single to come from the Bat Out of Hell album was released between August and October 1978 around the world, and was titled Paradise by the Dashboard Light. The old-fashioned rock and roll style song would see Meatloaf team up with the female vocalist Ellen Foley from the musical Hair, who incredibly recorded her vocal all in one take, as this duet would become one of Meat's greatest and most renowned songs of his career, despite that not exactly being reflected on the charts, as it failed to crack the Australian, New Zealand, and UK charts altogether. However, it made it to number 1 in the Netherlands, 2 in Belgium, 11 in Canada, and 39 in the US, where it sold close to 2 million copies around the world. Today, Paradise by the Dashboard Light is Meatloaf's second highest stream song on Spotify, with a total of 190 million streams and 87 million views on the music video on YouTube. A music video that was so good that it received loads of airtime when MTV first started up, which boosted sales. Originally, the track was met with criticism from record companies who found the 8.5-minute track too lengthy and found it too quirky and different to regular tracks on the radio. Even session band member Qasim Sultan, who played bass on the album, doubted the track and its success, and said, quote, "Through the whole process, I remember distinctly saying to myself, this is just the biggest joke that I've ever been involved in. I cannot believe that these people got a record deal. This is just crazy. I'll never hear this record. It's just a joke. It's a comedy record." While producer Todd Rundgren told Songfacts, quote, "I thought, this is really out of time, but if we play along with it and we do it right, maybe it'll sell a few copies. None of us really understood or envisioned that it would turn into what it did turn into." Despite the critics' opinions, the now famous song would become a fan favourite and an anthem for young lovers and teenagers in the late 70s, with the song being about a young man or teenager attempting to entice a woman to sleep with him in the back of his car, with the phrase paradise obviously alluding to the joyful feeling of sex for the younger man. However, the woman in question stops him in his tracks and claims that before they go any further, he needs to tell her he loves her and that he will marry her. After much deliberation and back and forth, telling the woman he needs to sleep on it, he eventually agrees, but not without feeling reluctant, as he just sees her as more of a one-night stand rather than wife material. As Meat claims that Paradise by the Dashboard Light has influenced many people over the years, with fans of the track coming up to him in person to say they gave birth to that song because it's so long, or that they lost their virginity or got laid to that song. During Paradise, Jim Steinman brilliantly splits the song into four separate parts, beginning with part one, referred to as Paradise, where the young man takes the girl out for a date at the envy of all of his other classmates and propositions to have sex with her and to go all the way. As Ellen Foley sings, "Ain't no doubt about it, we were doubly blessed, 'cause we were barely 17 and we were barely dressed." This then leads into part two, known as the baseball broadcast, where Jim Steinman very cleverly uses the metaphor of a baseball game and getting to first, second, and third base, as well as a home run, to having sex, as it is often referred to in the United States. During the song, a baseball commentator played by former New York Yankees shortstop Phil Rizzuto, can be heard narrating all the moves of a baseball game that can easily be adapted to the two teenagers being intimate, with lines like, "He's gonna slide in head first, here he comes, he's out, no wait, safe, safe, at second base, this kid really makes things happen out there," and the line, "Here he comes, squeeze play, it's gonna be close, holy cow, I think he's gonna make it." But right before the young man reaches his climax, we enter into part three, known as Let Me Sleep On It, as the young lady interrupts him, begging for the young man to commit to her, as Ellen Foley sings the famous lines, "Stop right there, I gotta know right now, before we go any further, do you love me? Will you love me forever? Do you need me? Will you never leave me? Will you make me so happy for the rest of my life? Will you take me away, and will you make me your wife?" This then begins a back and forth tussle, as the young man says, "Let me sleep on it," and instead plans to continue going all the way, and to give her an answer in the morning. However, the young lady remains persistent, and knows what she wants, continuing to ask him to commit. The young man eventually agrees, just so he can achieve his mission to get laid. However, he had now committed to much more than just a relationship, all for sex, as the song takes a negative turn and enters part four, called Praying for the End of Time, as Meatloaf sings the lines, "I couldn't take it any longer, Lord, I was crazed, and then the feeling came upon me like a tidal wave. I started swearing to my God and on my mother's grave that I would love you to the end of time. I swore that I would love you to the end of time, so now I'm praying for the end of time to hurry up and arrive, 'cause if I've got to spend another minute with you, I don't think that I can really survive." As time went on, Paradise by the Dashboard Light would become renowned as a cult classic, still receiving regular airtime on rock radio stations around the world. From Ellen Foley and Meatloaf's incredible vocal performance to Jim Steinman's masterful lyrical ability and arrangement, this song truly is a masterpiece and will go down as one of the best but most underrated duets of all time. Paradise by the Dashboard Light would often be played live and occasionally brought about criticism due to the baseball part of the song, where Meatloaf and the woman he was duetting with would come together on stage for a passionate embrace, acting out the scene, despite Meat later becoming a married man, and despite the fact that when he aged, he would perform the act on a much younger female vocalist, with her consent of course. However, not everyone bought into it, or found it appropriate. During the Bat Out of Hell tour of the late 70s, the original female vocalist Ellen Foley would pull out of the tour due to other commitments, as her career started to take off from here, and she would be replaced by Carla DeVito. As Foley controversially said, quote, "You're singing backgrounds, and then you go up and he sticks his tongue down your throat for 12 minutes. Despite this comment, when speaking with SongFacts, Ellen Foley claimed that they had great chemistry, and together they worked so well because they were so familiar with one another from the theatre scene. As she said, quote, "I had known him and been on tour with him, and we did crazy irreverent things that broke down any barriers. There was a sketch where I was a blind girl, and he was my boyfriend, and at one point, he was humping my leg, pretending to be my dog. All the crew and actors drove around the country in a blue van, so there was very little we didn't know about each other." While former Yankees star Phil Rizzuto, who was also utilized during the baseball part of the song, claims he wasn't aware that his part was going to be used as a metaphor for sex, and he has since refused to comment on the song or take part in any Meatloaf tour, as Phil began to receive outraged letters from conservative fans of his. The final single to be released from Bat Out of Hell would be released during October 1978, and was titled All Revved Up with No Place to Go. This was also set to be included in Jim Steinman's musical Neverland and sees a young man on the prowl, ready to make love and simply get his rocks off, with a girl he met on a night out, only to be shut down by her, and ever since then, he's been trying to find her again, as he can't take his mind off of her, or fulfill his sexual fantasies with her, hence the lines, "But every Saturday night, I felt the fever grow. Do you know what it's like, all revved up with no place to go? Oh baby, I'm a hunter in the dark of the forest. I've been stalking you and tracking you down, cruising up and down the main drag all night long." Featuring a killer saxophone hook, All Revved Up was actually the least successful of the five singles and failed to chart globally. However, to this day, it still receives radio airplay and remains another classic from the album. Another great track from Bat Out of Hell is the beautiful ballad Heaven Can Wait. The sad but emotionally touching track is arguably one of Meatloaf and Jim Steinman's most underrated songs of their careers, and sees Meatloaf or his character finding love and being content with remaining here on Earth to be with their one true love, with death no longer something they want to come anytime soon. Not only was this track beautifully written by Steinman and perfectly sung by Meatloaf, but it was far different to anything else on the album, and one of the most satisfying moments for Meatloaf was finding out years later that this song had actually saved numerous people's lives from committing suicide over the years, as it has a strong positive message in support of choosing to live, and that heaven or death can wait. As the beautiful lyrics read, "I've got a taste of paradise, I'm never gonna let it slip away. I got a taste of paradise, that's all I really need to make me stay. Just like a child again, heaven can wait, and all I got is time until the end of time. Well, I won't look back, I won't look back, let the altar shine." The final track from Bat Out of Hell would be titled For Crying Out Loud, and while this song wasn't to be a hit, it would go down as one of Meatloaf's favourite pieces of music and songwriting on Jim Steinman's part, as Meatloaf claimed it was the perfect love song. With this ballad rounding out one of the greatest rock and roll albums of all time, and one of the most successful. From November 1977 through to August 1979, Meatloaf with Jim Steinman and a nine-piece band known as the Neverland Express had been touring the Bat Out of Hell album constantly, performing as a headliner on the same bill as Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and Eddie Money, all across the US and Canada and through to the UK. Performing live would be Meatloaf's favourite thing to do of all, however the tour didn't kick off all that well, with a gig supporting Cheap Trick in their hometown of Chicago. Meat was badly taunted for his weight, but despite the insults that continued to flood in by rude and rowdy concertgoers, Meat pushed through and completed the band's debut gig. As Meat said, quote, "By the end, they didn't exactly like it, but they had stopped calling me a fat fuck. I considered that a victory. It took me years to get over that show." According to Meatloaf, he weighed around 340 pounds at the time of the release of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, which was the equivalent to 154 kilograms. According to their tour manager, Sam Ellis, he claimed that things started to turn around when they performed a back-to-back gig at the Bottom Line in New York City for radio station WNEW-FM, who played the gig on air. As he told Classic Rock, quote, "That's when I knew that if we could hold things together and keep on growing, what we were doing had a future." Ellen Foley, who duetted with Meat on Paradise by the Dashboard, had to pull out of the tour due to other commitments on Broadway, so Carla DeVito would take her place, sparking rumours that Carla and Meat were dating, due to their spicy onstage chemistry during the raunchy song. But instead, Carla fell for Meat Loaf's tour manager, Sam Ellis, which Carla believes broke Meat's heart and left him in tears when he found out, as Meat Loaf had clearly developed feelings for her, despite the scene in the song being purely acting for her, as Carla was quoted as saying, "For Meat, that hostility was completely shocking, because coming from the world of theatre, he was used to being adored." When asked by Classic Rock who was the captain of the ship, so to speak, Carla DeVito, Meatloaf's co-singer, on the track Paradise by the Dashboard, claimed her partner Sam Ellis, the tour manager, was the reason they became so big, as she said, quote, "I'm sure Meat thought he was the captain, and Jim was like a deposed captain who had been placed under arrest and slung down below in the brig. The true captain was Sam Ellis, the road manager. Without Sam, as a live act, Meat Loaf couldn't have got past that first gig in Chicago. The pirate ship would have sunk. Sam was Meat Loaf's confidant and truth teller." Tour manager Sam Ellis appeared to agree with DeVito when he spoke to Classic Rock, as he said, quote, "Yeah, I was the guy steering the ship. It felt like riding the tail of a comet. We started out in the clubs with a second-hand mobile home, a station wagon, and a truck, and ended up playing arenas with two tour buses and several trucks. That was challenging, but it was also satisfying. From that first show with Cheap Trick, we soon realized that we shouldn't be opening for anybody, so we took it to the clubs and became headliners." Sam Ellis claimed, however, that Meat wasn't easy to manage, as he said, quote, "He had a stubborn streak, and when he became like that, he would dig his heels in. There were many times when we locked horns." Despite this, the live shows continued to bring in positive reviews and sell out crowds, as the venue sizes quickly grew in capacity. The shows were wild and full of energy, as Meat Loaf, despite his size, would run about the stage always working up a sweat, and believe it or not, Meat Loaf, who was also an asthmatic, would actually require an oxygen tank to be at the side of the stage in case he passed out during or after the performance, as he would always give 110% and overexert himself, throwing everything he had into his vocals and his onstage energy. Many times, bandmates were concerned that he had killed himself after a gig, as he would be laying backstage unconscious as his team would rush to give him oxygen. Meat Loaf claimed he would always give his all in everything he does, whether it be interviews, live performances, or being there for his family. The year 1978 would prove to be the wildest out of the Bat Out of Hell tour, with Meat Loaf starting to become overworked and tired of life on the road. During March 1978, Meat Loaf and his band had a meeting in Washington, D.C. in a hotel room, where together they were set to watch the debut of their music video for Bat Out of Hell on TV. But as it came on, Meat's big music video debut would be ruined when the tape played on the broadcaster appeared to stretch and Meat's voice began slowing down and becoming distorted to the point that it was hard to listen to. Meat was so embarrassed that this would be broadcasted all over the country, and he stormed out of the hotel and was nowhere to be seen for at least 4 days. As he told Behind the Music, quote, "I didn't say a word to anybody. I remember doing this, getting up out of that room, getting on the elevator, walking out the front of the hotel, and that's the last thing that I remember until 4 days later. I woke up in a hotel in Toronto, Ontario. I lost 4 days of my life, and nobody knew where I was." Luckily, Meat Loaf made his way back, and the band carried on their tour. On the 22nd of April 1978, Meat Loaf even started a riot at a gig at the Tower Theatre in Upper Darby, Philadelphia, in the USA, with tickets, believe it or not, at the time, selling for less than $7.50. Meatloaf was going through a reckless phase at this point of the tour, as he sculled a bottle of Jack Daniels before going out and performing. The gig was being broadcast live to radio from Tower Theatre, as Meatloaf began to egg the crowd on to get rowdy and fired up, with Meat's band calling it the Battle of Philadelphia. Meatloaf would recall the incident, saying, quote, "I was throwing mic stands into the audience and breaking guitars and throwing mic stands at the band as the crowd went nuts." Then, on the 22nd of April, 1978, Meatloaf, at a gig in Ottawa, Canada, at the Ottawa Civic Centre ice hockey rink, now known as TD Place Arena, Meatloaf would break his leg after falling off stage and onto the hard icy floor below, with radio host Eric Olper claiming that Meatloaf had become entangled in cables on the stage before falling off. As a fan named Bram Moorman, who was present that evening at his first Meatloaf gig, told Ottawa CTV News, quote, "All of a sudden he just disappeared. You know, like boom, he was gone, and then the announcement came on and said, Meatloaf has fallen off the stage, and that was the end of the show. And I found out a little later on that he had broken his leg." However, Jim Steinman remembers the event a little differently, and claims that Meatloaf had it all planned out to injure himself just to get out of doing a show in Albany, Nova Scotia, in Canada, the following day, as Meat, Jim, and the band were all tired and needed a well-earned break from their busy schedule. According to Jim, Meatloaf would risk it all, knowing the floor had an ice-cold hard surface, as he purposely slid on his knees across the stage at the end of the show, before falling to the floor, breaking his leg, as the band were left to instrumentally finish the final song of the set. The audience were then informed that Meat was being rushed to the hospital, and the Albany show was cancelled, with Meat returning to perform in New York, bound to a wheelchair, for the next month, with a cast on his leg and all. In the middle of the tour, during December 1978, the now 31-year-old Meatloaf attended Bearsville Studios in Woodstock, New York, with Jim Steinman by his side, when a young female secretary and studio assistant working at the studio caught Meatloaf's eye. Her name was Leslie Gay Edmonds, a 27-year-old bombshell from Norfolk, Virginia. As Meatloaf was swept off of his feet, as the pair hit it off instantly, arranging a few dates, falling head over heels for one another. After just 10 days of being a couple, they became engaged, when on a snowy winter's day at the Bear Cafe, Meatloaf got down on one knee and proposed. But instead of presenting a ring the old traditional way, Meatloaf presented a rather unusual token of love, as Todd Rundgren claimed that he presented Leslie with, quote, "a giant whole salmon, and it was as if a bear had proposed to his mate, instead of a ring, a salmon." Just 2 weeks after becoming engaged, Meatloaf and Leslie would marry during January 1979, as things moved along very quickly. Leslie thought it was too soon, but Meatloaf claims jokingly that he was going to rip his heart out of his chest and let it pump blood into the white snow if she said no. As Leslie told Behind the Music, quote, "He was an unlikely prince on a white horse. He was a big fella, and he had a funny name, and when he worked on stage, he was really sweaty. And when I rang my mother and told her I was going to marry him, she said, 'That big sweaty guy on TV,' and I said, 'Yeah.'" Leslie Gay Edmonds was born on the 21st of May 1951 in Norfolk, Virginia, to her parents Edgar Edmonds and Virginia Allen, and already she had a daughter named Pearl Maria Edmonds to a previous marriage, with Pearl's father being known as Clark Pearson, who was formerly the drummer of Janis Joplin's group, the Full Tilt Boogie Band in the late 60s. However, sadly Clark wasn't around for Pearl, so Meatloaf would automatically become a father figure and stepfather to her. And by 1979, Meatloaf would legally adopt Pearl, becoming her father by law, with Pearl now going by Meat's surname of a day. Leslie, Meatloaf, and Pearl would then move as a family of three to a house in Stamford, Connecticut, on Eagle Drive. With Meatloaf riding high with Bat Out of Hell's success and his personal life, CBS began beating their chest, claiming that Meatloaf and Jim Steinman were their own discovery and throwing their support behind them financially after all this time. But with success came its troubles, especially for Meatloaf, who significantly struggled to deal with the sudden rise to stardom, as he would suffer from severe nervous breakdowns on tour, to the point that he would be occasionally rocking back and forth in the corner of a room, as Jim claims that Meat was difficult to deal with on tour and would break down constantly with the sudden fame. Meatloaf would be lucky enough to meet many greats of the industry, and despite being famous himself, he claimed he was often starstruck when in the presence of John Lennon, Frank Sinatra, and Elvis Presley, who he met backstage, as Elvis had come to watch the Rocky Horror Show in Meat's early theatre days, as Mr. Presley asked to meet Meatloaf and Tim Curry, with Meat freezing in the presence of the King. During 1975, Meatloaf also met John Lennon for the first time in a coffee shop, as he said, quote, "I got my coffee and asked the guy next to me, 'Could you pass the sweet and low?' And then I heard his voice, and the minute I heard him, I knew it was John Lennon. If I had an idol in the music business, it was John Lennon. I wanted to talk to him so bad, but everything I thought to say, I thought, 'No, that's stupid.' So the only thing I ever said to him was, 'Thanks for passing the sweet and low.'" Jim Steinman claims that he and Meat had a disagreement while on tour when at a show in Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania, as the show had been billed as just Meatloaf, omitting Jim's name completely, which, as stated earlier, made Meat feel uncomfortable. So, feeling the pressure of being the main attraction, and feeling rebellious against those that booked the gig as just Meatloaf, as a way of standing up for his buddy Jim, Meatloaf didn't follow their usual show opener and came out onto stage and started yelling, quote, "You ready to party hard, Pittsburgh? You ready to party?" And despite his good intentions to stand up for Jim, Jim didn't see it that way and said, quote, "He became to me every other rock and roll band. I was just withering up. I was horrified. We had a big confrontation afterwards with Meatloaf in the hotel room, and I remember it was really violent. He was really upset, because to him, it was like questioning the validity of him as a person, like I can't talk to my own audience. It had become his audience. It was his name, which is understandable. But to us, it was a scripted piece, a theatre piece, and that's where the real conflict started. It was a problem for him, and he got so upset that he couldn't say that. And to us, it's simply artistic. It wasn't interesting, him saying, 'You ready to party tonight?' It just didn't fit. This great Marvel Comics character, you know, it's like Batman saying, 'Hey Gotham City, you ready to party? Hey Robin, come on, let's boogie.' It didn't fit that world. It wasn't mythic at that point." Jim claims that after this, he confronted Meatloaf about his actions during the gig. Meatloaf got upset and swung into a rage, breaking windows, mirrors, and throwing a chair through the window of the hotel room, before stomping off into the night, leaving Meat's bandmates and Jim to go out and look for him. Jim claims, quote, "We had to go looking for him because he had tried to take his life a few times." As Jim revealed that Meatloaf had tried to take his life during the recording process of Bat Out of Hell, and he also often made threats to end his life. With a group search party out looking for Meatloaf, Jim would be the one to find him, standing alone on a football field, claiming that he saw meat from a mile away as he saw steam emanating from his large body, as he often got so hot, sweaty, and steamy. As Jim claims, that meat said to him, quote, "I'm not a Frankenstein monster, I'm meat." While grunting, before charging into a stationary truck and splitting his head open. Meatloaf would receive stitches and luckily survive the ordeal. However, Meatloaf himself would never actually back up Jim's version of events over his whole lifetime, perhaps embarrassed by the situation or from being wasted and not remembering a thing. Jim Steinman would often leave the tour to go and start writing material for their next album, so he would occasionally miss some of Meat's outbursts on tour. However, he also remembers another moment during the Bat Out of Hell tour when Meat lost control once again at a gig in Philadelphia, where Meatloaf opened for Southside Johnny, which was being broadcast live on WMMR radio. Meatloaf had been warned prior to going on air not to curse, but ignoring these rules, as he walked onto stage, Jim claims that Meat said the word motherfucker numerous times, as he said, quote, "How you doing, you motherfuckers?" about 40 times in a row. From there, the gig turned into an absolute disaster, as the piano Jim was using broke 6 keys, as he plays the piano quite hard. Meanwhile, Meat was a little bit drunk and started throwing beer bottles around on stage and pouring gin all over the bass guitarist, Kasim Sultan. But sadly from here, Meat's anxiety and panic attacks only worsened when their record label began to pressure Meat and Jim to produce a follow-up album to Bat Out of Hell. And this time, their label wanted to go bigger, better, and to ultimately sell more records. Placing this kind of pressure on Meatloaf at this time made him especially frustrated and overwhelmed him, as Bat Out of Hell, of course, was huge, and he thought there's no way that they could replicate that or even top that. Despite his doubts, during the winter of 1979, Meatloaf, Jim Steinman, the Neverland Express, and producer Todd Rundgren returned to the studio once again to begin production on their second studio album, which was in the early stages, called Renegade Angel. However, during the early stages, when Steinman joined Meat on stage for a gig in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Jim's lyric book of new songs for the album had all been stolen. Traumatized and devastated by the theft, Jim lost loads of potential songs and was only able to recover 3 of them initially that he could remember. Meatloaf already wasn't a fan of how pushy the label had been to duplicate the Bat Out of Hell album, as the label and management had advised Jim and Meat to stop touring and focus on a new album. Adding to the tension was the fact that Meatloaf wasn't happy with Jim's songwriting this time around, claiming it was too similar to Bat Out of Hell, which didn't help him buy into the whole thing, finding the album too contrived and commercialized instead of being different and daring like their debut album. Around this time, Meatloaf and Jim were also rumored to have butted heads more than once, with one particular scenario escalating over the fact that Jim wanted to use the studio musicians from Bat Out of Hell for their latest album, while Meatloaf wanted the road band that had just toured with them to feature on the album. Despite many witnesses claiming they would always butt heads, Meatloaf claimed that they never really had any arguments at all, and that the media used to make it all up and attempt to put a wedge between them. However, he does recall one particular argument where Jim was questioning the way Meat was singing, to which Meat replied, "Don't ever tell me how to sing, and in a rage, he flipped Jim's piano over and stormed out. However, the issues surrounding the album would just be compiled when it came time for Meatloaf's vocal recording to begin. Meatloaf shocked everyone present at the time, including himself, when he literally lost his singing voice and all of his confidence just went out the door with it, only managing to let out squeaks and pitchy notes. As producer Todd Rundgren told VH1's Behind the Music, quote, "There were notes that he couldn't hit with the same strength or tone any longer, and this was like freaking Meatloaf out completely." Jim was also shocked and was quoted as saying, "Sounded literally like the little girl in The Exorcist, like a dragon trying to sing. It was a horrifying sound." After 6 agonizing months of attempting to record the second album, Meatloaf finally gave in and quit the band for now, as he looked to sort out what was going on with himself. In the meantime, Jim Steinman decided it would be best to continue on without Meatloaf, and that he would become the lead vocalist for the album instead. A move that would cause a rift between Meat and Jim's relationship going forward. It was reported at the time in the media that Jim and Meat had a falling out, while rumours also swirled that Meat was suffering from issues both physically, mentally and emotionally, and that's why he had to leave the band. And while this was partially true, the issue or issues were much more complex and varied. As Meatloaf said in relation to why he lost his voice, quote, "I paralysed a vocal cord. I think it was partly psychosomatic, because first of all, I really protested the second record." Meat's wife at the time, Leslie, claims they tried everything, including taking Meat to vocal coaches, doctors to take a look at his throat, to see if there was any damage. They tried many different psychiatrists, and even hypnotists, all across California. While a rumour even circulated that Meatloaf even tried drinking his own urine to cure his vocal condition. But not only did he lose his voice, Meatloaf was also struggling with fame and with being called a star, which ultimately resulted in Meatloaf being taken by his wife to therapy sessions to see a psychologist, which would take up to 2 years before he felt comfortable enough to return and to shake the nervous breakdowns. As Meatloaf claimed that the word star or superstar would become a trigger word for him, as he hated being called one and felt uncomfortable with stardom or fame. He felt he hated being placed on a pedestal by people who are really no less than him. As Meatloaf claims that everyone has their jobs, whether you're a nurse or a firefighter, but for him, he's just a singer and an entertainer. Meatloaf would tell Dan Rava much later in 2016 that over all the years, quote, "I will not allow them in any advertisement, record, touring, anything, to use the word legend, star, or superstar, because I consider myself just another human being with a different job than the plumber. I have a job, and that's what I do." While he told Absolute Radio, quote, "I don't consider myself as famous. My mama told me, never brag." Seeing a psychologist, however, actually helped get to the root of Meatloaf's issues, as they were mostly internal thoughts and psychosocial, as he just needed to get his confidence back and stop feeling guilty or disgusted in himself for being labelled a star, as he told Behind the Music, quote, "He walked in and he says, 'What's the problem?' And I said, 'People are calling me a star and I don't like it.' And he says, 'Okay, well, can you call yourself a star?' And I went, 'No.' And the day in his office, he said, 'Can you call yourself a star?' And I went, 'Okay, I'm a star.' And he goes, 'Okay, you don't need to see me anymore.' And then I looked at him and I said, 'But I don't believe it.' And he goes, 'It doesn't make a difference if you believe it or not.'" The 2 years of recovery were rocky and troublesome, however, as Meatloaf almost attempted suicide yet again and fell into a bad habit of abusing cocaine. He tried acid and also started drinking more alcohol. As Meatloaf explained in his autobiography, quote, "I was out on the ledge of a building in New York and I was going to jump. The police and fire department were there. Sam Ellis talked me down. I don't even remember being on the ledge." Sadly, Meat would battle with depression and suicidal thoughts for much of his career. Meat would also comment on his drinking and drug taking, stating, quote, "I never was Steve Tyler or Ozzy Osbourne. I tried drugs, but I don't really drink." With Meatloaf then claiming in another interview that he hates beer and, quote, "I get horrific stage fright, so I have a shot of tequila to calm my nerves. But that's 3 hours before I go on. I despise the taste of beer. I don't like vodka. I don't like scotch. Champagne makes me want to gag. I've never been that cliched rocker. I don't have many wild stories from the 70s or 80s. The 60s, though, were crazy. I did acid and hung around everybody like Hendrix, Daltrey, Joplin, and the Dead," while he also told Behind the Music in regards to his drug problem, quote, "Drugs became an issue for me, and I hate for my kids to hear this, but it really did. It kinda destroyed things for me." Meatloaf's wife Leslie and his children, however, were his rock through that difficult period, as he told Rolling Stone, quote, "I felt like a leper. I felt like I was on an island with my wife and my two daughters." During this time, Meat and his family struggled financially, as he was unable to use his singing voice to make money. Not one to back down from a fight, Meat took any chance he could and landed a couple of film roles, including as the character Roy Butnitz in the 1979 film Americaphone. He also starred as the character Scum in the 1979 film Scavenger Hunt, and his first lead role in the 1980 light-hearted comedy film called Roadie, playing the character of Travis W. Redfish, as Meat portrays a fun-loving Texan truck driver who loves a beer in a bar fight as he falls in love with a rock star named Lola Bula Bass and travels around with her to gigs, essentially becoming her roadie, as he stars alongside Kaiki Hunter, Alice Cooper, Blondie, aka Debbie Harry, Roy Orbison, and Hank Williams Jr. While the film wasn't a massive hit, acting was always something that Meat aspired to do, and it may have been the confidence boost and change of scenery from the music business that did him a world of good. Either way, it kept some money coming in so he could support his family. Eventually, Jim Steinman got sick and tired of waiting for Meat to return during this 2-year period, telling Rolling Stone, quote, "The problem was with a million different forces. His manager, his lawyers, his vocal cords, his brain. I actually just left. I spent 7 months trying to make a follow-up with him, and it was an infernal nightmare. He had lost his voice, he had lost his house, and he was pretty much losing his mind." So Jim got moving and began to record the second album. Jim Steinman decided to step up on vocals, recording the second album during August 1980 to March 1981, with Canadian vocalist Rory Dodd also contributing vocals on 3 tracks from the 10-track extended album version. Jim had always actually wanted to be a frontman, and he saw this as his opportunity, despite not being as great a vocalist as Meatloaf. By April 1981, Jim Steinman released his debut and only studio album of his career, titled Bad for Good. Despite a promising rise up the charts in Australia, coming in at number 5, and in the UK at number 7, the album struggled in the US and the rest of the world, coming in at number 63 in the USA. Commercially, it sold reasonably well and was considered a moderate success. However, Steinman was heavily criticised by critics for his poor vocals and cheesy lyrics, such as "I'm a lover, not a dancer" in the cringy pop song "Dance in My Pants." Three singles would be released from the Bad for Good album from May to October of 1981, including "Dance in My Pants," "Lost Boys," and "Golden Girls," and the most successful of the singles, "Rock and Roll Dreams Come Through," making its way to number 5 in South Africa, 6 in New Zealand, 18 in Australia, and 32 on the US Hottest 100. However, it also made it to number 14 on the US Rock Mainstream chart. With Jim writing the track about how rock and roll music always pulls you through the hard times. At the time, with Jim releasing Bad for Good without waiting for Meatloaf to return, Meatloaf claims he felt slightly betrayed and deflated. However, he believes as time went on, he realised why Jim had to choose to move on and felt he had let himself down, as his voice just wasn't up to scratch, and neither was his mental state. He was, however, disappointed that band members Todd Rundgren, Roy Bittan, Kasim Sultan, Max Weinberg, and co-vocalist on Paradise by the Dashboard, Carla DeVito, all chose to work with Jim on the album while he was gone. Meanwhile, Meatloaf, his adopted daughter Pearl, and his wife Leslie had welcomed Meatloaf's first and only biological daughter into the world on January 21st, 1981, naming her Amanda Leah Day after she was born in New York City. During this time, Meatloaf had also been attending regular therapy sessions. He and his family had moved to Westport, Connecticut, and he had lost some weight after becoming a vegetarian. He also began playing softball regularly, while his singing voice had seemingly returned, as he began to feel as though he was ready for his comeback to the music business. Then, during early 1981, after nearly 2 years since walking out of Todd Rundgren's studio and on Jim Steinman, Meatloaf would return once again to record their next studio album, titled Dead Ringer. From February to June 1981, Meat, Jim and the gang got busy recording and laying down a fresh batch of tracks as Meatloaf looked set to make his long-awaited comeback to the music business, and his vocals had improved out of sight, showing no signs of the vocal issues he experienced during the last studio sessions. Meatloaf was back in business and things looked to be on the up for their second studio album together. However, would it all go to plan? Stay tuned for our next episode as Meatloaf enters the Dead Ringer era. And that wraps up this episode of Lyrics of Their Life podcast. Thank you all for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If this is your first time tuning into our show, don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button so you don't miss our future episodes. And if you're really enjoying the show, a quick rating or review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts goes a long way in helping us to grow. If you would like to follow the podcast, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, X, and TikTok at Lyrics of Their Life Podcast, or on our website at lyricsoftheirlife.com for updates and more. If you'd like to support the podcast further and help keep episodes like this coming, you can head over to my Patreon at patreon.com/lyricsoftheirlifepodcast, or you can buy me a coffee over at buymeacoffee.com/lyricsoflifepod. Every bit of support means the world to me and helps make episodes like this one possible. Whether you're a long-time listener or just discovering the show for the first time, thank you for being here and supporting the show in whatever form that comes in. Thanks again for listening. I'm your host, Adam Hampton, and this is Lyrics of Their Life.